Here we go. Wednesday morning Bible study out of the book of Acts. We're going to do chapter 12 today, and much like I did last week on chapter 11, chapter 12 is only 25 verses. I typically do 15 to 20, which is usually about a half a chapter. So last night I was able to get through all of chapter 12. We're going to do all of chapter 12 today as well. It's a shorter chapter. So if you remember in chapter 11, Peter had reported to the church this good news but strange news that Gentiles are now included. He talks about his vision. He talks about the events that took place at Caesarea when he preached to them. They also received the Holy Spirit and began speaking in tongues. He reports all of that to the church. And then there's this description about how in the initial dispersion of believers at the time of the martyrdom of Stephen, that the believers started spreading around, it said, Luke said in chapter 11, that they only spoke to other Jews. So again, there was that initial thought that the gospel message, the new Christian religion, the messiahship of Jesus was only for Jews. However, then it mentioned that there were some believers in Antioch who were talking to Hellenists or Greek speakers, Gentiles. Whoa, what is this all about? Is this something, is this related to what Peter's telling us too? Well, this is strange news to their ears. So they send Barnabas. And remember Barnabas? He was all the way back, I think, in Acts chapter 4. He was a faithful Levite, so he's Jewish descent, knowledgeable of Jewish ways, but he also was very aware of what's going on with Jesus. And back in chapter 4, he brought an offering and laid it at the apostles' feet. Now he's some semi-leader in the church, you know, probably he's a committee chairman, you know, some kind of leader. So they send Barnabas up to Antioch to check this out. What's going on up there? He gets up there and he sees that, yes, in fact, the Gentiles are believing in Jesus and have joined the church, and how wonderful this is. He doesn't quite know what to do, but he knows of Saul, the ex-Pharisee who had the conversion to on the road to Damascus. And he knows Saul is in Tarsus, which is just across the bay. You remember that map I showed? It's just a little inlet right up there in the corner of the Mediterranean. So whether he walked around or got a ride across the bay, he went to Tarsus, found Saul, and brought him back. And they taught for a year in Antioch, building up the church there. So a year has passed in the events of chapter 11. Then the Antioch church hears of the famine, and they send an offering down to Jerusalem to give relief to their fellow believers in Jerusalem. And they send it by the hand of Barnabas and Saul. Okay? That was chapter 11. That was way too long of a summary, wasn't it? Whatever.
That was good.
I'm just kind of spouting off. All right, any questions about that or where we are? Are we caught up? Okay, about that time, so this is, you know, Saul and Barnabas arrive with the offering from Antioch. About that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. Now, yes, he's related to the other Herods that you know. So let me give you just a little bit of backstory to this. Herod the Great was the first one. He was at the time of Jesus' birth. So Herod the Great, which would be the grandfather, is the one that the wise men came to and asked, where will the Messiah be born? Herod the Great was known as being particularly ruthless. He was only half Jew and half Idumean, so the Jewish leaders generally didn't like him. He wasn't a complete Jew. He was akin to the Samaritans in that regard, only, you know, partial or mixed heritage. So in order to curry favor with the Jews, Herod the Great, back then at the time of Jesus' birth, rebuilt the temple gloriously. Well, that is a blessing, actually, to them back then. Apparently, it was, you know, near the glory of what Solomon built back once upon a time. But he was ruthless because when he heard from these magi that a savior had been born, what did he do?
He killed all the babies. He
sent some soldiers to kill all the babies and infants in the town of Bethlehem out of jealousy. Mm-hmm. to prevent this Savior from being king. So that's Herod the Great, he was called. Ruthless, terrible. When that was happening, God sent an angel to Joseph in a dream to tell Joseph to do what?
Get up and leave.
Flee to Egypt, which he did that very night. It was a very impromptu and sudden thing, and they had to act quickly. Bethlehem is only 10 miles from Jerusalem, so it wouldn't have taken the soldiers long to get there. So Joseph flees, and then we hear from Scripture that about 4 years later, the Holy Family in Egypt hears that King Herod died. So now they come back. So that would be, yes, there's some dispute about the exact dates and the error by a month, but that would be about 4 A.D. If you assume Jesus was born in the year zero, although, again, there's a year or two off, some error, I don't know, but 4 A.D. So they come back. So Herod dies, and he is replaced by his son, Herod Antipas. That is the son of Herod the Great. Herod Antipas is the one who is reigning when Jesus is crucified. Herod Antipas is just as ill-tempered and bad-natured as his father. So you remember when Jesus was on trial before Pilate, and Pilate hears that Herod is in town for the Passover, what does he do? Sends Jesus over to Herod. Let Herod deal with him. Herod tried to get him. This is Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great. So Herod Antipas tries to get Jesus to do some magic tricks to entertain his party guests. Jesus is completely silent. So he sends Jesus back to Pilate. Says, it's not my deal, your deal. You deal with it. That's Herod Antipas. Apparently, did I write down the year? I did not. At some point after that, after the time of Jesus' crucifixion, Herod Agrippa, that's this Herod, who is the grandson of Herod the Great by way of a daughter. So Herod the Great has a daughter. The daughter gets married, and the son is Herod Agrippa. That's this Herod. So this Herod Agrippa is a nephew to Herod Antipas. Okay? Herod Agrippa reports his uncle, Herod Antipas, as being complicit in sedition and rebellion against Caesar. He reports him, his own uncle. You know, you read about history of, you know, like English kings and French kings, and how often do they backstab each other? And they're all relatives. Right?
Yeah.
Power, it somehow corrupts people. It does. We know that.
Yeah.
So the grandson here is turning in, accusing, I don't know if it was false or not, accusing his uncle, the Caesar, and so Caesar exiles Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great. He's exiled to Spain, and that's where he lives out his life. And then Herod Agrippa takes over. So now he's ruling. This is Herod Agrippa. Okay? Just as nasty as the rest of the clan. The whole Herod clan. They're nasty, Pete. They're only part Jews, so they have some Jewish knowledge, but they really don't care about the Jews. They're just after power and control. All right? So he laid hands on some who belonged to the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. This was during the days of unleavened bread. So why did he seize some who belonged to the church and then kill James? Well, like his grandfather, he's trying to get favor with the Jewish leaders. The Sanhedrin, the high priest, the Jewish leaders, they don't believe in Jesus. This is a false religion. They still want to stamp it out. One of their primary persecutors of this new religion, Saul, has been converted to be one of them, but they are still interested in persecuting. So Herod is trying to get favor with the Jews by arresting some Christians, and he kills James, the brother of John. Yes, this is that James, Peter, James, and John. James, one of the primary apostles, okay? Kills him by the sword. Maybe that was merciful. Because if Jews were to execute somebody of their own accord, how would they do it? Stoning. Not really the best way to be pelted with rocks till you're dead. If he had been executed by the Romans, what would they have done?
Crucified
him. Yeah, that's awful. That's terrible. And we know from church history, all of the apostles, save one, were executed in gruesome manners. Okay? So maybe, you know, James actually got off a bit merciful here. He was the first of the apostles. So Stephen was the first martyr. James is the first of the apostles to be martyred right here. And so just to reiterate again there in verse 3, when Herod saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. So he must have arrested James right before the Passover, and he arrested Peter during the Passover. This was during the days of unleavened bread. That's another name for the Passover. Well, that's the highest holiday for the Jews. The highest holiday. And here, Herod is arresting Peter. So, when he had, verse 4, when he had seized him, he put him in prison. Why did he do that instead of just slaughtering Peter right off the bat? Well, because it's during the high holidays. He doesn't want to offend the Jews. So he's willing to arrest Peter during Passover, but not yet execute him. Yeah, a little bit odd, isn't it? But his hand is stayed by the crowd, by the crowd of Jews, particularly the Jewish leaders. That's interesting. Can politicians be swayed? Can rulers be swayed by crowds of people?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they can. They're subject to pressure. So, verse 4, when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending, after the Passover, to bring him out to the people. Okay? Four squads. So, the Roman army had subdivisions and little minor divisions within it. So we know a centurion was a ruler over 100 men. A centurion would be the equivalent of today, like a lieutenant or a captain. And he would have 100 men under him, and those men would not just all report directly to the centurion. They would be divided into squads. In the modern day military, how big is a squad? Anybody know? Anybody in the military? Jerry, were you? You were in the Navy?
Air Force.
Air Force, okay. So that might be a little different. Lauren, were you in the Army?
Yeah.
How many are in a squad?
I think about 15 or 20.
Okay. So the Roman army generally was divided into squads of about 10, and the squad would be led by a veteran soldier among them. So then these veteran soldiers of each squad would report the centurion. It just makes the delivery of orders easier. So four squads, we're looking at somewhere around 40 soldiers. Now why is Herod putting 40 soldiers over to guard, approximately, to guard Peter? Well, remember what happened back in chapter 5? The Sanhedrin arrested Peter with their temple guards, and Peter was let loose during the night by an angel. So then the next morning, they sent their guard, go fetch Peter, and the guard came back and said, he's not there. And then somebody came running in and said, that guy you arrested yesterday, he's up in the temple courts. He's preaching about that Jesus fella. You remember that? That was back in chapter 5. So one of the commentaries that I was reading particularly for this is Dr. Lenski. He's a Lutheran commentator, seminary professor from about 100 years ago. He wrote a commentary, and he said, this is Herod throwing down the gauntlet and challenging God, try to get Peter free now. Peter got free by an angel back then. Well, I'm going to put four squads of soldiers around him, so you can't free him. So Dr. Lenski, kind of tongue-in-cheek, is saying, this is Herod challenging God to try and get Peter free. All right? So, Herod's intending to bring him out when the Passover is over, so the high holidays are done. And so Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. So, the young fledgling church of believers, they were praying for him. And he's in prison. All right? Comments or questions? Okay. Onward. Verse 6. Now when Herod was about to bring him out on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains. and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. So yes, they're not going to let anything happen. They have sentries at the door, and they have soldiers in the cell, keeping an eye on Peter. And what's Peter doing?
Sleeping.
Sleeping. Now, Dr. Lenski, I'm going to lean on him a couple times during this little bit here. Dr. Lenski says that shows that Peter expected that he was going to be executed, much like James just was, a matter of days before. James was killed by the sword, probably run through by a sword. Peter knows it's going to happen. Jesus predicted it, didn't he? Jesus predicted Peter would die for him. So Peter must be at peace with the fact that he's about to be martyred and he's asleep. Imagine facing this turmoil, this conflict, this direct confrontation with King Herod, and you're so calm about it, you're asleep. Wow. Quite a change in Peter from the loudmouth, brash disciple he used to be, right?
Yeah.
So I thought that was a good insight from Dr. Lenski. Yes, I think that's pretty true here. Peter's asleep. Verse 7. And behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to him, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him, saying, "Get up quickly." And the chains fell off his hands. He struck him. You know, it's scary enough to see an angel. Angels are scary. They're fearsome creatures. And here this angel smacks him. I imagine it doesn't say hit, it says struck, so I'm thinking it must have been a slap. So the next time I get slapped by someone, I'll say, "Oh, are you an angel? Did I just get struck by an angel?" Struck by an angel. Wasn't there a TV show about that? Struck by an angel?
Touched
by an angel. Well, you know, being slapped by an angel is a touch. If anybody watched that show, I never did. Touched by an angel. Did the angel ever slap somebody? Yeah.
I don't.
You know, you're already scared enough of angels, and then the angel comes up and smacks you one. Why did the angel smack him?
Wake him
up. That's what it says. And woke him, saying, "Get up quickly." And the chains fell off his hands. So the chains just dropped off. Oh, there's something happening here. God is about to make it happen. Sends an angel to do that. And verse 8, and the angel said to him, "Dress yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. Why is that? Because prisoners would usually be stripped, part of the punishment, either completely naked, or they might just have their undergarments on, or, you know, whatever, their underneath clothes, partly for embarrassment, partly for extra punishment because you'd be cold. Okay, so that was common. So his clothes had been taken off of him and his sandals, and they were probably over in a pile in the corner, and he's there chained to the wall, and two guards are standing on either side of him. Okay? So the angel says, "Dress yourself and put on your sandals." He did so, and he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and followed him. Okay, verse 9 there starting. Now, maybe like me, your mind wanders and says, "What about the guards?" Because that's what I think.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Sorry.
So what about the guards? There's two guards standing there. There's guards at the door. Well, we don't know precisely, but a little bit of speculation, and again, I'm going to go back to what I read from Dr. Lenski in his commentary, that the guards must have had their attention refocused or their vision clouded or their senses clouded in some way. Think of it almost as though maybe they're in a trance somehow. That the angel can distract their minds or put a shroud over their minds so they're not aware of what's happening. They're just kind of oblivious. They're standing there somehow not aware of what's going on. Yes, that in itself would be a miracle. Okay, so we don't know exactly. It doesn't say, but we have to. We can make the correct assumption that somehow the angel clouded or distracted the guards, so they were not aware of what was going on. Okay, so we are in verse 9, and he, Peter, went out and followed him, the angel. He did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. He's already seen other visions. And he went to sleep. So he probably thought this is just another dream or a vision in his sleep. And then, you know, if he had pinched himself, he'd realize, no, he's actually awake. This is real. Any of you ever had that happen to you, where you were dreaming and you pinch yourself and you realize it's a dream? I had that happen to me once. Does anybody, I've told this story before. Anybody remember me telling that story? No? So I guess I should tell it again, right? Since I introduced it?
I should say, which story?
Yeah, which story, right? So I'm turning into Pastor Q. Story number 217.
Okay. I'll record it.
Except for him, it'd be story 1217.
That's right.
So real briefly, here's my story, and it's not long, but I was a teenager, we were getting up the next day to go to Cedar Point. I was all excited. My family, we're going with some cousins, you know, it was going to be a great trip. So I wake up in the morning, I get ready, we get in the car, it's a 2-hour drive from where we live, we get to Cedar Point, we're lined up, we're getting on the brand new roller coaster, the biggest and best yet made at that point. This is awesome. This is going to be tremendous. I can't believe I'm here. I'm about to ride this ride. And I pinched myself, and I couldn't feel it. And I tried it again. I said, am I dreaming? And then I woke up. And I'm back in my bed, and I'm like, oh, now I got to get ready, and I got to go on a 2-hour car ride again before I can get to that. I got to wait in line. I got to do it all over again. It actually happened. That's a true story. Wow. And I remember pinching myself and saying, why can't I feel it? And that's when I woke up. So yes, that really did happen. To me. So, he thinks this is a dream or a vision. He's seeing a vision. Verse 10. When they had passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city. It opened for them of its own accord. And they went out and went along one street. And immediately the angel left him. So, in order to get from the city proper into the inner cell, there's an iron gate that you would have to go through from the street to get into the prison. And then from that point, at some point, they passed two other gates, two other doors that were the first guard and the second guard. So there's two other points that they had to go through in order to get to the inner city. So they're coming out. And the angel takes them past the first and the second, but then the big iron gate that closes the entire prison. How does it open? By itself, which means who opened it? God opened it. So God is involved here. He sends an angel, but God is still here, present and involved. So God opens it. They go out. They go just one street away, and the angel disappears. So now he's out in the cool night air. Probably comes to his senses. He wakes up a little bit. Maybe he pinched himself and realized this is real. I'm not dreaming. I don't know. And when Peter came to himself, so verse 11, oh, let me scroll down a bit. When Peter came to himself, he said, now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting. What were the Jewish people expecting? His execution. Right. The Jewish leaders especially were expecting, yes, Herod is doing us a favor. We hate these Christians. As soon as Passover is over, he's going to bring one of their leaders out, Peter, and we're going to get him executed. So that's what they were expecting. And Peter realizes God saved him again. Herod threw down the challenge. And what did God do? Oh, four squads of soldiers are nothing for God.
No.
Frankly, one angel, with the help of God, got Peter out from under the nose of four squads of soldiers. All right. When he realized this, that's Peter, when Peter realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. So this is the introduction to us of John Mark. Okay? Anybody recognize that name? He's the author of the Gospel of Mark. John Mark has some distant relationship to Jesus' family. So his mother Mary, I don't know if she was a second cousin or something. So we find out somewhere else in the Bible and in church history that they were distant relations. Okay? Kind of like John the Baptist was a cousin to Jesus, but that was like a first cousin. So, distant relations. John Mark, we know from the early church fathers, was a companion of Peter. So when Peter went around and preached and taught, John Mark was usually with him, following him around, listening to his preaching, assisting him when he could or when necessary. Okay? So somebody last night asked the question, you know, we have a lot of writings in the New Testament from Paul. We don't really have that much from Peter, which you might be surprised by, because Peter was, you know, kind of the leader among the apostles. But we do have the two epistles from Peter, 1st and 2nd Peter. We also have a number of Peter's sermons and teachings here in Acts. We've already heard some of Peter's sermons. And the entire Gospel of Mark is written down on the basis of Peter's preaching. So John Mark became a companion to Peter and his scribe. So Mark is based on Peter, okay? Here's where we are introduced to him. He will come up a few more times in the book of Acts. He will also be mentioned in other books in the Bible as well. So we know a little smidgen about him, plus what we know from early church fathers who talk about John Mark. So that's John Mark, okay? All right. So they go to his mother's house, Mary, where they're gathered and were praying. And he knocked at the door of the gateway. A servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Rhoda.
Rhoda.
Wow. Well, there's another TV show.
Yeah.
Right? We're full of TV shows today.
Right, yeah.
Smacked by an Angel and now Rhoda. What was Rhoda a part of?
Mary Tyler Moore.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, why is Rhoda mentioned here? This is the only place she's mentioned. Well, you know, Luke, who's writing this, Luke could have said, a servant girl came to answer. Why does he say, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer?
Confirmation?
Yes. So, the first generation of readers of this would have known who Rhoda is. So they could go to Rhoda, and Luke is, you know, hinting at this. If you want verification of this entire event, go talk to Rhoda. She's still in the church today. You can go talk to her and she'll verify this is all correct. There's a dozen or more people in the New Testament, in the letters of Paul, in Acts, in the Gospels, that are mentioned one time and never again. One mentioned by name. Why does that happen? And it happens not a ton, but I'm going to say it more than a dozen times. The reason that happens is so that the first generation of church members, they would know that person and they could go talk to them for verification. Okay? So that's Rhoda. He knocked at the door. A servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice, in her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. Oh, silly girl! What in the world? You recognize his voice. Is that you, Peter? Oh, hooray! And then she runs in. It's like, let me in! I just can't help but laugh at that. I'm like, oh boy. So, she runs in and reports that Peter was standing at the gate. They said to her, you're out of your mind. He's in prison. But she kept insisting that it was so, and they kept saying, it is his angel. What do they mean by that?
They think he died.
Yes. They think he died, and this is his ghost. His angelic ghost. Okay? Now, they had some misunderstandings about death and the afterlife, just like we do today. There was a Jewish myth that when you died, you became an angel. Some people mistakenly think that today, too, right? You see that on what, It's a Wonderful Life. Or, you know, where, maybe not that, but I don't know. You know what I'm talking about. There's this, you know, a whole bunch of myths that are not true. Oh, I'm so glad Grandma is up there watching me, looking down on me from heaven. No, she's not. That'd be a sad event, looking down in heaven.
Yeah.
Looking down on earth from heaven. All the turmoil down here, that, you know, That doesn't happen. Well, I'm so glad every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. No.
That's from
a... When you die, you become an angel. No. You don't do that either. That would be a demotion. You know, humanity is the pinnacle of creation, not angels. So they had the mistaken notion here that, oh, maybe Herod already executed him, and this is his ghost of an angel at the door. They don't believe that this Rhoda servant girl must have really been a silly girl if they don't believe her. They don't even believe her. What's wrong with you, Rhoda? Isn't that a Peter out there? Yeah, it is. Okay, verse 16. I suppose none of us are ever silly like that, right?
No, never.
Verse 16, but Peter continued knocking, and when they opened, they saw him and were amazed. Oh, Rhoda, you were right. Wow, it's Peter. But motioning them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of prison. So did he go like this, perhaps? Did he go like this, you know, like be quiet? I don't know. He made some motion to them. Be quiet. Why would he want them to be quiet? You know, this is late into the evening, or I'll say early in the morning. Maybe the sun is about to rise, or maybe it's in the process of rising. The streets are still generally empty, but there's some people starting about. He knows they're going to be looking for him. He doesn't want anybody to hear. There might be some passerby on their way or an early trip to the market, or might somebody around the corner. Shh, be quiet. Don't want anybody to hear me. So he's basically whispering. And he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of prison. So he tells the story to them. And he said, tell these things to James and to the brothers. Then he departed and went to another place. He left and hid. He went off the grid, we would say today. Okay, so he's gone. He says, tell these things to James and to the brothers. Wait a second. James was just killed. Who is this?
Jesus' brother.
Correct. Jesus' brother, or we might say Jesus' half-brother, if
yeah,
you will.
Half-brother.
Because this James was the oldest of Jesus' siblings, and James is the son of both Joseph and Mary. So in the natural way, not miraculously conceived like Jesus was, okay? So James, Jesus' half-brother, we would say, or we could just call him his brother. Now we know from history, again from early church fathers, that Jesus' siblings, did they believe in Jesus while he was alive? No, they didn't. His family rejected him. But after he rose from the dead, he appeared to many disciples, including his family, and James became a believer in Jesus. James, the brother of Jesus, started to believe Jesus was, in fact, the Messiah. And he believed it so much, and of course he knew all the stories of Jesus, and he probably was with Jesus on many events that took place. James rose to prominence to become the leader of the Christian church in Jerusalem. Okay? We know that from early church historians. So that's this James. By the way, this is the James that wrote the book of James in the New Testament. Okay? It's the brother of Jesus. Alright? So, Peter says, tell these things to James and to the brothers meaning the other apostles. Yes, there's a footnote here that will say brothers and sisters. However, the word there is brothers. And yes, you can use brothers in a generic sense to mean people. You can. But I think here, in this case, it means brothers, meaning the other apostles, the leaders of the church. Go tell them that I was brought out of prison, I was broken out of prison by an angel, and I'm free. And then he goes and hides. Because he has to. Alright? Okay, onward. Questions? Comments? Yeah, Anne.
Just a comment. So they are amazed that he is released. And I have to think that their prayers were just that his life would be spared.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't imagine that they could pray for his total... freedom.
You know, that is a good point. I should have brought that up. Think about this. They're praying for Peter. They're likely praying, just spare his life, and, you know, keep him in prison. Maybe we can communicate with him. He can still talk to us. Spare his life. And what does God do? God answers more than they're likely praying for, and to their perspective, immediately. They're praying, and there's a knock at the door, and it's Peter. How often would you have prayed for somebody, and then the phone rings, and you find out, oh, exactly what I was just praying for, and it happened. Well, I think that occasionally occurs to us as God's people, but most of the time that's not how it happens, right? That's kind of amazing here. Power of prayer, yes, good observation, Anne, thank you. Yeah, Fred.
Would have Herod sent out looking for more Christians to persecute?
Probably.
So when they, it says they went and opened the door. So
yeah.
There was a bunch of them that went. They
yeah.
didn't just send Rhoda back.
Yeah.
Hey, because there was a bunch of soldiers coming.
Sure.
In.
You know, if there's a bunch of soldiers standing there ready to storm the door, yeah, you got to be careful. Right. Yes. So persecution of Christians is ramping up again. That's correct. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, verse 18. Now when day came, there was no little disturbance among the soldiers over what had become of Peter. Why would that be? No little disturbance. Yeah, they're going to be in huge, big trouble. Verse 19, and after Herod searched for him, for Peter, and did not find him, he examined the sentries and ordered that they should be put to death. Then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and spent time there. That was the penalty both among Jewish temple guards as well as Roman soldiers. If you fell asleep, or were irresponsible while on sentry duty, the punishment was execution. So what would that cause you to do? Stay awake at all costs. Stand on your feet. Maybe smack each other. Keep yourselves awake. You do what you have to stay awake, because your life is at stake. All right? Phil Cole was here last night. He's an ex-Marine. I said, so Phil, as a Marine, what would happen if you fell asleep on duty? He said, if it was a minor offense, probably a demotion. If it was a major offense, they might discharge you dishonorably from the Marines. But it's not death. It's not even necessarily prison. Here's death. They're slaughtered because they fell asleep, or they think they fell asleep. They don't know. They don't know what happened. Wow. Yeah, see, the whole Herod clan is ruthless.
Yeah, they are.
Okay, then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and spent time there. Okay, now, first of all, I can tell you, I didn't mention this, I'm looking at my notes. All the way back here when we say, about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church. We know that James, the brother of John, was executed, died in 41 A.D. Okay? According to the common reckoning of Jesus being born on the year zero. Which again, yes, there's some dispute about that. It might be legit. I don't know. So if this is 41 A.D., this is taking place 8 years after Jesus rose and ascended into heaven. Okay? Just to give you some time frame. So these first 11 chapters of Acts. Now, Acts chapter 11 was a whole year itself. Because remember at one point in Acts chapter 11 it said that Barnabas and Saul taught for a year at the church in Antioch. So time is passing. I don't want you to have the impression that here we are in Acts chapter 12 and it's 2 months after Jesus ascended into heaven. No, it's 8 years. Okay? So time has passed through these chapters. Chunks of time. Alright? Back to where we were. Oh, then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and spent time there. Now, Herod was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and they came to him with one accord, and having persuaded Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they asked for peace, because their country depended on the king's country for food. So if you remember that map we had from last week and the week before, Tyre and Sidon are along the coast, they're part of Phoenicia, and they were port cities. They did not grow their own food. But because they were port cities, they had money from trading, and therefore they bought their food from Israel, King Herod's country, Judea. Okay? They bought their food from there. So does this sound like politicians today? Herod is angry at them. We don't know why. He's mad at them. So he stops selling them food. So they come and plead to him, oh, please let us buy food. And they have to bribe the chamberlain in order to get an audience with King Herod. Boy, this sounds like politics, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it
does.
Did they have a tariff on the food?
Yeah. Yeah, was there a tariff? And was the tariff being increased? So, yes. So this is all going on. All right. So verse 21. On an appointed day, Herod put on his royal robe, took his seat upon the throne, and delivered an oration to them. So he took his spot on the throne, and he's going to hear them as in their audience. They come and plead to him, and he delivers an oration. He lectures them. He's pontificating. Can I use that word? We're Lutherans. Can I say pontificating? He's pastor measling them. Today seems like more lecture than a discussion. I'm in lecture mode right now, I guess. So yeah, he lectures them. And the people were shouting, verse 22, the people were shouting, the voice of a god and not of a man. Whoa. Why would they say that? They're trying to flatter him, aren't they? And it was known in the Roman Empire, what did the Caesar, whoever he was, what did he consider himself? One of the gods. And the people revered him as one of the gods. So here, they're trying to flatter Herod, to curry favor with them so they can buy food. And so they declare, oh, he's one of the gods. Not a mere man. He's a god. And what does Herod do? He doesn't refute it.
There were probably people in the crowd who were told to say that.
Could be. Were they riled up by someone in the crowd? Perhaps. Yeah. So, he doesn't refute it. We know that because of the next verse here. He doesn't discredit that claim that he's a god. He accepts it. Well, what does that say to the true God? Now, Herod is only half Jewish, but he's still... supposedly, in his background, he understands Jewish ways. That's an offense. That's blasphemy. So, verse 23. Immediately, an angel of the Lord, an angel, not the angel. Immediately, an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory. So right there. He received and accepted the accolades that he was a god. And therefore, an angel of the Lord struck him down. And he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. My question is, what order did that happen in? It's kind of three things there. He's struck down by an angel, he's eaten by worms, and he breathed his last. Is that in a specific order? No, I don't think so. It's kind of probably all simultaneously, maybe. But eaten by worms might be a reference to what happened to him after his death, because that's a reference to our body's decay, right? Mm-hmm. So he's struck down by an angel, he breathes his last, and then when he's buried, he's eaten by worms. One last reference to Dr. Lenski, who surmises, and again, it's just a guess. It is known from Josephus that Herod Agrippa, that's this Herod, had digestive issues and stomach problems. He may have had parasites or a tapeworm that caused his digestive issues. So Dr. Lenski is claiming, based on the evidence of Josephus, maybe this is a case of when he was struck down by the angel and he breathed his last, and they're preparing him for his burial, the parasites that were within him started to come out. And so it appeared like he breathed his he was eaten by worms. Okay? I don't know if that's true or not, or if being eaten by worms is a reference to his decomposition in the grave. But in any case, it's kind of a gross way to describe somebody's death. All right? Not a pleasant way to die.
No.
Well, when they prepared people for death and wrapped them, whatever, did they not? Were those people eaten by worms when they were buried?
No, generally not. No, the Jewish habit would be to use spices to maintain, to keep down the smell, but also to anoint the body. They'd wrap it in linen. They would not embalm. Embalming was known. The Egyptians embalmed. They did not embalm, and then they would bury the body within 24 hours. And then it was known that at some point in the future, you know, worms would eat away the dead body, and it would turn to dust. But that would take place in the future. They wouldn't actually see that. So if they saw it here, then that leads a little bit of credence to what Dr. Lenski said. Maybe he had parasites, and the parasites are starting to emerge as soon as he dies. I don't know.
This shows that he was a man and not a god to these people that said, you are a god.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, this is showing he's not a god. He's a man.
He's not a god, and
yeah.
I'm approving.
Yeah. More like throwing down a challenge to the true god, that he's a god. No, he's not. And the true god proves it, striking him down instantly. He's dead. Yeah. Now, we know that Herod Agrippa, that's this Herod, died in 44 A.D. So, chapter 12 takes place over a three-year span. So now more passage of time. The only reason I mention that a couple times now is because Acts takes place over a couple of decades. And if you read through Acts, and as we're going through it, you might get the mistaken notion that all of this takes place in the year after Jesus. No, this is all taking place in a couple of decades. Okay? So, we're now at the year 44 A.D. All right? Yeah, the kids are loud. A couple more verses. We're almost done. See, we're going to finish in an hour. Told you. Verse 24. But the word of God increased and multiplied. Despite all this controversy, the execution of James, the arrest and disappearance of Peter. Peter goes into hiding. Yet what happened? The gospel is still being preached. The gospel message is still going forth. It's being carried by just everyday believers. That'd be you, telling your family, your friends, your neighbors about Jesus, even though there's persecution going on. Could that happen again in our world? Well, it already is in certain places, right? Just for talking about Jesus, you could be arrested? Yeah. Verse 25, and Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had completed their service, bringing with them John, whose other name was Mark. So there's John Mark again. Second time we hear from him. So, I don't know what this means when they completed their service. Yeah, Fred?
Didn't they go down to Jerusalem to give support?
Right.
Down?
Right.
Maybe that's all part of that.
Maybe that's probably what it means when they completed their service. Their service to the fellow believers in Jerusalem. They completed their service, so then they went back to Antioch. The way that it says completed their service, it almost sounds like they were enlisted to do some form of duty within the Christian church there. Oh, you've got a 3-year term as chairman of the board of properties, so you got to stick out your term of chairmanship before you can go. No, it sounds like that. I don't really know, but I think you're right, Fred. It's probably a case of their service of giving an offering to the people there, and they go back to Antioch. Which is known to have become another center, a church center. So in the early church, Jerusalem was the primary center of Christianity. Antioch became another center of Christianity right about now. Okay? A decade, we're 11 years actually, after Jesus, Antioch is about to become another center of Christianity. And then you know what else becomes centers of Christianity in the coming decades? Alexandria, down in Egypt, also Constantinople, also Rome. Rome will become a center of Christianity as well. Okay? So that's just a little look into the future from this point. Not our future, their future.
Right. Back to the future.
Back to the future, there you go. Another movie reference.
Yes.
Wow! All these TV show references. Okay, questions? That's it, the end of the chapter.
So we have this succession of Herods.
Yeah.
Why was there still a king?
They were serving at the agreement of, or the leisure of, or the pleasure of the Caesar.
So it wasn't the Jewish people that gave them.
Correct. Correct. And if you look at Josephus and other like histories of the time, the Herods had to pay or bribe Caesar to be appointed as king. So, you know, if you're a Caesar, or if you're a king, in the way that we might think of king over an entire area, you still needed other officials to help. You couldn't govern everything. Just like the president today, he has a cabinet, and then there are governors over each state. So the king, in this case, Herod, and sometimes there was a king, and sometimes there was a governor. Pontius Pilate was a governor. So it all depends on Caesar. So Caesar could say, okay, I'm going to make you governor over there. I'm going to make you king over there. You're charged, I'll give you 2 legions of soldiers. You're charged with keeping the peace, and also you have to raise this amount of taxes for me, and then this amount of taxes for yourself. And then, I want to take a census 3 years from now. You're in charge of the census of that area. So it's a delegation. So yes, Herod called himself a king, and maybe Caesar allowed him to have that title, but he got it through manipulation and political intrigue and or bribery. Because what happens if you're the governor or the king and you're in charge of taking taxes from this region? You have to send this amount to Caesar. Well, what do? You take a little extra. And where does it go? In your pocket. So it's a lucrative position. So if you were of means and you had connections, yeah, you would want to get yourself appointed. And I'll use that word, appointed. So he was appointed king. He wasn't a ruling or reigning king in the way that you would think of kings.
That's what I was curious
about. Yeah. Okay, any other questions?
How did Jesus' brothers, how were they brought up?
Well, they were skeptical. They were doubtful. We know that because when Jesus tried to preach in Nazareth, his hometown, the people there were doubtful. And it says, aren't your brothers here? Are your brothers and sisters here among us? Your mother is here? So they were skeptical or doubtful, but I don't think that they were outright hostile to Jesus. They were just doubtful. Oh yeah, he's the golden child. He's the perfect one. He never does anything wrong. Mom and Dad like him best. You know, sibling rivalry. There was probably some of that going on. So they're doubtful, they're questioning, and what's going on? And then they hear that Jesus at the age of 30, now they would have all been younger than that, that Jesus at the age of 30 starts to go around preaching and teaching, and he's doing miracles. So they would go out and hear him. They would have heard some of his sermons. They would have seen some of the miracles. And again, in their mind, they're like, what is this? We don't understand what this is going on. We grew up with this guy. How do we know what he's saying is true? So there was a lot of skepticism. And they weren't really believers in Jesus until after the resurrection. Then they became believers in Jesus. And that's when they became members of the church. And James, the brother of Jesus, the oldest of his siblings, became the leader of the Christian church in Jerusalem. Okay? Yeah, Dale and then...
Plus, wasn't it a significant cultural anomaly that Christ was not married? And so you would expect the leaders to be married.
Yeah, you would.
When he's coming, I mean, where's your wife? Because you need the help.
Yeah, there was a cultural expectation you would be married. Yeah, that's right.
Significant variation there.
Sure.
Not normal.
Yeah, something's not right here. Yeah. Sally?
We don't hear much about Jude, his other brother.
Yes, you're right. Jude is another brother of Jesus. So that short book in the Bible, Jude, that's also written by one of the other brothers of Jesus who became, we know from early church history books, Jude also became prominent in the Christian church in Jerusalem. Not as prominent as James, but we know that Jude was also a brother of Jesus. You're right. So, no, we don't know too much about Jude, other than that short book that he wrote and a little smidgen from church history. Yeah. Yeah, good point. Other questions? Yeah, Ellen.
You know, is that kind of thinking kind of the way, the reason why most pastors usually do not ever go to their home church and, you know, be the pastor?
Yeah, it is. It's not forbidden in the Lutheran, in the Missouri Synod, but it's discouraged. And yeah, for that reason, if I went back to my home church, people would say, oh, I remember him when he was in the school and he was this big. And, you know, it was, you don't view such a pastor as a pastor. You view him as, you know, a little boy from decades ago that I remember when he was, you know, knee high to a grasshopper or whatever the saying is,
yeah.
Right? So, yes, it's not forbidden, but it is discouraged today in our church for a pastor to go to his home congregation. So, we are not the home congregation of your grandson. So, he could come here, right? He's deeply embedded in the seminary, though, so that's a good spot for him with all the music. Yeah. All right, other questions? Comments? All right, if you're able, please rise. We'll close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thanks for coming. Have a nice day.